gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is our review episode for Friday the 5th, August 5th, as it will soon be known, Suicide Squad Day, as it will go down in history.
Suicide Friday. That'll go over well.
We'll be celebrating it every year. We're going to be talking about Suicide Squad, the latest installment or chapter or sequel in the DC Comics cinematic universe. I don't know what people call that. I guess that's just the DCU.
The MCU.
MCU is a little easier to say. I don't want to sound like I'm paid off by Marvel already, but it rolls off the tongue. DCU, I don't know what to say. Anywho, Suicide Squad follows Batman v Superman from last March. And I called it in a recent write-up a spin-off of Batman v Superman, but I got grilled for that. I guess it's not a spin-off technically.
Who took you to task for that?
Faceless Facebook commenter number one.
Uh-huh. And what did,
was quite upset.
What did he? And I'm going to go with.
You are correct. You're correct. How did you know? They just said that it was a part of the DCU. It was another film in the Batverse, uh-huh, as opposed to a straight spinoff. But I would contend with that because both Batman, Ben Affleck's Batman, and The Flash both make appearances.
They do, but it is, I would say that the film is...
Is that a spoiler? I should say up front, I think we're going all in on spoilers for this review.
Yeah,
so.
But I have to imagine that anyone who gives a shit about the DCU is aware that Batman is in this movie. I mean, I thought that was common knowledge.
Yes, both of those little cameos have been revealed. If you are a Dave Seven of the world, then you know all this. And if you're not, you probably don't give a shit.
And The Flash had a larger role in Batman v Superman than he does here. And that's a low bar.
That's true. He's really just the opposite of Captain Boomerang in the Suicide Squad.
We'll get there. But the movie does feel like a bridge between Batman v Superman and Justice League, particularly, and we won't necessarily have to spell this out, but with the post-credit scene sort of cementing that bridge.
Although the post-credit scene feels like it was shot before some of the extra material stuffed into the middle of Batman v Superman, because you don't really need the post-credits bit in this movie to really make that connection, but yeah. Who's paying attention? Something's after the credits. Stick around. So what is Suicide Squad? Just for reference purposes, Suicide Squad is an actual comic book, also known as Task Force X, and it's been around for actually a very long time, back to the 50s, and there was a second version. We should always give shout-outs to the people who create these comic books, because they do a good job.
Do you have to have read Task Force A through W in order appreciate this?
I was actually thinking Task Force Yes, exactly.
Yes.
John Ostrander is the guy who kind of reinvented Suicide Squad and gave us the one that we're looking at kind of today, plus Harley Quinn. And
well, it's worth noting, I think, also how, speaking, joking however poorly about the prerequisites involved, it's pretty remarkable how quickly this movie launches into its plot, its team building plot, wouldn't you say?
I don't think it launches into its plot very quickly. In fact, I think it takes a very long time to actually figure out what this movie's going to be about. What it has a lot of fun doing and what it gets into immediately is the Ocean's 11 style, let's introduce the cast kind of
setup. I think we
mean
the same thing, which is that it really doesn't beat around the bush. It goes, never before has a film gone from zero to team building quite so quickly.
It feels, in that way, it feels more like a comic book. A lot of this movie does, that it's just kind of like panels or issues and totally fragmented, really just there to give you fan service or put these two characters in a room and then what happens, or have this person do this action scene and then splash, 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 who really cares what happened before or after? It's all about that singular moment or an introduction in this case.
But if you hadn't seen Batman v Superman, I think, not that the movie makes much of an effort to ground this story in any applicable politics, things that can be tied to anything that's happening in the real world. I mean, it's conversation about deterrence are so far removed from any practical examples of that, that it's just completely up its own butt. But if you hadn't seen Batman v Superman, I can imagine how you wouldn't be lost necessarily. It's pretty clear because Viola Davis's character, who is a government agent, lays out the her agenda in the baldest of terms. But I do think that a lot of the a lot of the atmosphere, a lot of the energy around the story that is supposedly meant to buttress it would definitely be lost.
And yet, even though Viola Davis does, and she plays this character, Amanda Waller, who is a government agent going to kind of wrangle the metahumans and create this suicide squad of sorts to fight, I don't know, potential threats like Superman. She makes a kind of passing reference to, now that Superman has come in as this godly force, how would we ever push back?
What if the next Superman is a terrorist?
Yes, and even though Superman is dead and Batman is around, she still feels the need to come up with the Super Squad. And what's so interesting is that this movie is totally insular. There is no outside force that they really are threatened by besides themselves, and they create all of their own problems and then solve them by the end.
Now, that would be,
like, in every beat.
The way you say that makes it sound interesting. I think that the idea of a superhero movie where they are shooting themselves in the foot and I mean, you see this a little bit in The Age of Ultron, Ultron is essentially being one of Iron Man's creations. But then, of course...
Though it builds there over many movies.
And of course, you have Thanos sort of still in the background. What you say here is absolutely true. Unfortunately, once they cause their own problem, it takes on such a hollow life of its own and becomes the most generic, the least interesting threat that... any sort of fun that could be had with the idea of them being their own worst enemies, these being villains themselves, is lost.
As someone who is allergic to quote-unquote nerd-ass shit, David, I would like to hear you set this movie up. The very simple plot, but the kind of why the Suicide Squad needs to form together and what they're taking down is so... extraordinary. It made my jaw drop. What happens in this movie?
Well,
what is this about?
So, you know, Viola Davis is looking to round up the worst of the worst. She's essentially filling Con Air, but with metahumans and the otherwise disturbed. When the film begins, and this is a real lost opportunity, all of these people have already been put into custody by Batman. And so much of the story is rooted in the past tense. We see flashback after flashback, even 90 minutes into the movie when a character is revealing the emotional impetus that drives them forward. It's all done in flashback. Everything in this movie is in the past tense. Everything that's interesting, at least, or omitted altogether. But you have Harley Quinn, a.k.a. Dr. Harleen Quinzel, who's played by Margot Robbie, who is most definitely the face of this movie. Who is anyone familiar with the Batman mythos, even casually, will recognize her as his sort of sidekick, girlfriend, sexual abuse victim, psychological abuse victim, a doctor who has turned to the Joker's prom queen and plaything, and partner in crime. And she doesn't have any special powers, but of course she's pretty involved in the fight in the end. She's a girl.
That is what's interesting about this. They're all about fighting metahumans or gathering the metahumans here on our planet, or the bad ones. And yet, I think only one of them, maybe two, are really, they have superpowers.
Yes, and one of them...
Most of them are just good at shooting things.
Yes, I mean, Deadshot is the best at shooting things of anyone. He is played by Will Smith. He is the greatest superhero in all the world. I'm talking out of my ass right now. He is the greatest shot in all the world. But he, as we are told all these people are, is a bad guy. And we know he's a bad guy because the movies have never dealt with a lovable hitman before, time and time and time and time again. But he is a hitman. He has a young daughter. All of these men, all of the male characters in this movie have a vulnerability in the form of a woman. For Deadshot's character, it is his young daughter. He kills bad people for money. And he is one of these guys. And then you have El Diablo, played by an unrecognizable Jay Hernandez, whose vulnerability is also a woman. And he is one of those metahumans Matt was referring to, who he's a pacifist now, despite the fact that he is clearly ripped out of LA's gang culture. He's covered in gang tattoos. He is a fine, upstanding representation.
He spends most of his time figuring out what kind of like dancing women he can make out of fire, or what he can spell with fire.
Not at all a stereotype.
No.
And he is woof. So there's that guy. There's the crocodile. There is
his name is Killer Croc.
Whatever. There's Captain Boomerang, the butt of any joke regarding this movie, because he is an Australian guy whose superpower is looking absolutely indistinguishably similar to Tom Hardy, actually played by Jai Courtney.
No, his superpower is he can pull a beer out of any place or time. He always has a beer. Uh-huh. And apparently a pink stuffed animal. I didn't really understand that. But.
Yeah. And then there's Joel Kinnaman, who's the you know, good old American soldier, leader, Rick Flag, leader of this squad. They are his responsibility. He has implanted explosive tracking devices, very Battle Royale-like in their necks. And he is in love with Cara Delevingne's character, who is...
Her name is Dr. June Moon.
Dr. June Moon.
My God.
And she is possessed by a... And again, we're harkening back to the ancient past here, where so much of this movie's emotion is rooted, by a 6,000-year-old-plus Aztec goddess named... Well, really, I mean, she must have a name beyond this, but referred to in the film as Enchantress. And she... She will become the big bad of the movie, very helpfully, as much as their love story. He's in love with her, is central to what happens in the movie. They have exactly zero scenes, so they are allowed to show any affection for one another, which
they smooch once. They have an early smooch. That's about it. And then she becomes Gozer.
Yeah. No, really. I mean, it's
it really looks
full
like it.
Zool with this thing, but in the worst way possible. Anyway, so they get all these people together. They want to have a task force that's ready to fend off any sort of metahuman threat. They end up causing one. They get sent on a mission that has an ulterior motive into Midway City, where, there's not a single living person in this city. And that's before they turn all of the supposed citizens into identical Last of Us-looking googly-eyed head monsters. Because nothing makes action pop like a horde of anonymous CG henchmen.
In the dark. Who are black themselves.
This whole movie
Obsidian
takes place
black.
At night. It's,
But mostly indoors, so you don't really know.
Right. But the whole, not just this world feels self-contained, as you were saying earlier, but the film, it feels like it's taking place in this isolated pocket of time. They reference the destruction that's happening on a global level. And this is clearly like an extinction level threat that they're dealing with. But the impact, at no point do they even really attempt to make you believe that this is affecting anything beyond this CG green screen city that you can see. It feels very much like a story that's happening in a vacuum, which really guts the stakes. But of course, we haven't talked about the one last character that I'll lecture about before passing the baton and moving on, which is Mr. J himself, the Joker, Jared Leto, sending dead pigs and supposedly
dirty condoms
and such and such, all his co-stars. He's in this movie for maybe 10 minutes. Each of them, each one of those minutes, more poorly handled than the last. And his... this is sort of symptomatic of a movie that doesn't... its characters are all supposedly bad. They are constantly reminding us how bad they are. Harley Quinn says, "We're the bad guys." Deadshot looks at Viola Davis's character and says, "Don't forget, we're the bad guys." You will forget, because they are all just basic superhero types. There is nothing believably bad about them. This would have been such a more interesting movie had it really gone the R-rated route and had, like... And I'm using an extreme example here, but like a child rapist as a character. Like, that would be interesting.
That would
like,
be weird.
It would be very weird and would not fit in with really anything as a palatable commercial project. But just that's the most extreme example I can think of. But it's like finding people who are truly irredeemable, who are truly evil or diseased in a way that society doesn't know how to deal with.
Well, if the Joker could somehow be on this team.
Yes, and that is the key. That's what I'm getting to, is that the Joker, who is really the one character who's in it for himself, who's in it. A chaos agent. He is not part of the Suicide Squad. He is not the villain. he is just sort of this distraction that dances around the movie and then upends it at the very, very end in the dumbest way possible. It's a very unsatisfying performance. It's overblown in the media for a long time now.
What do you think? What is his purpose in this movie? Like, what do you think the Joker? Why is he there? Just because? Well, we can market that. You know, that's very easy. Slap that on. We'll have Joker and Harley Quinn. People love those characters. Throw them in there. I mean, does he serve a purpose beyond that? He doesn't seem to be pushing the story forward, provoking Harley really in any way. I mean, she's kind of caught up in him. There's most of his scenes are flashbacks to how she, you know, got sucked into his aura and then convinced to dive into a vat of chemicals for him, to live for him, as he says.
That scene is bizarre.
It is very weird. It is very weird, but it's not really serving anything in the present, as you said. It's not motivating her to be good.
I'll play devil's advocate and say that the purpose of the character in the abstract is to sort of set the tone, is to create this world where to use a character that we are familiar with. And if we were not, if you were not sort of educated in the history of the Joker, as anyone walking in the Western Hemisphere is, just sort of by birth, this character would make absolutely no sense, and not in the way that he's meant to make no sense. But it's he is coasting while trying to do something that pivots a little bit away from Heath Ledger and Jack Nicholson. In my estimation, he ends up being a lot like Jim Carrey in The Mask meets Scarface. There's a lot of gangster culture in his and Harley's.
Well, he's like the Joker that Joel Schumacher didn't get to have.
Right, he's like the Joker as the Riddler. But still, he's drafting off of our pre-existing understanding of who the Joker is. If not for that, you would be like, "What the fuck is this person?" I think it's just trying to set the tone to say like how disturbed maybe Harley is and the energy that these characters have. Setting him up, and this is maybe the more practical answer: setting him up for a future installment where he can be the bad guy. I don't know. It, whatever it is that they're going for, and only time will tell, it doesn't work. It doesn't work here. It doesn't serve this story.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how you spin him off, or maybe he's the villain in some future installment, but he just seems, he's in a vacuum. He doesn't really have a character or a motivation. He's apparently obsessed with Harley Quinn, but he leaves her to die on multiple occasions and doesn't really scramble to get her back. He's not psychotically driven to get her out of jail. He's not just gunning people down or bursting down walls.
She's definitely more into him than he is into her.
But not even, like, she's not unhinged. You're waiting for her to be really loopy and be as crazy as her sheet, her rap suggests, but no one is going over the line or really needs to be chained up in the Hannibal Lecter straitjacket.
Right,
in
I mean,
this movie, which is weird.
She's hypersexualized. I wrote in my review that she feels she wandered out of the not Suicide Squad XXX parody.
There's a shot that David Ayer just takes the cranes up her entire body and then snap to a wide shot where all the men are looking at her.
I mean, her
and just
I you know, certainly I don't mean this with tongue wagging. And there are legitimately more shots of her ass than there are half the members of the Suicide Squad in this movie. It deserves higher billing than Jai Courtney
than Adam Beach.
Certainly Adam Beach.
Oh my God. What a disgrace that what's funny about Adam Beach, he plays his character Slipknot, and since we're going full spoilers, let's just say he comes and goes pretty quickly in this movie, and he plays this character Slipknot. He does appear in, like, he's not introduced with everyone else. Everyone gets an introduction at the beginning, he does not, and yet in a later scene with Amanda Waller talking about assembling the Suicide Squad, there is his picture among everyone else. Who is this guy? Well, he shows up to the first time the team meets, and it's like, oh, that's Slipknot. He's the guy who can, like, shoot, or he can, like, I don't know, swing from building to building or something. Okay, great, get him in there. And then, bam, he is dead. He dies, like, two scenes later. What the fuck is going on in this movie?
It's amazing how, in a movie that is really all team building until, unfortunately, it no longer is, David Ayer, who wrote and directed the script, which is somewhat unusual for these mega franchise superhero movies, he keeps introducing new characters long after the point where you have expected them to keep showing up. Like the Japanese girl, whatever her character's name is, like literally jumps on the helicopter as they are taking off to go into downtown Midway City and you know, get the fighting underway. Like, just when you think it's over, there's more room for me.
Everyone on the plane has the same look we do when she just, who are you? Oh, that's my sidekick. She has a sword. Yeah. Back off. It sucks up your soul if you die. Okay, sure. Let's go.
And it's like, it's, yeah, it's...
Well, so let's, you know, as someone who wrote a review on the internet and will take the wrath of the DC fandom, David, I want to make a distinction here. Now, you kind of liked Batman v Superman, right?
No.
Okay.
I have a predisposition to look on the bright side when it comes to these superhero movies that, or at least I did, that veer away from the Marvel formula because I sure. just because I think the upside is a little bit higher, the potential upside. They have a higher ceiling because they're not so locked into a successful formula. There is more room for surprise. I say this prior to Doctor Strange, which looks aggressively different, and I hope follows through on that. But, you know, these movies, DC hasn't figured out what works for them yet. And so in their tinkering may hit upon something. The Wonder Woman trailer is promising. But if you are buying into trailers at this point, you're already been conned. But
what's interesting, I think, about Suicide Squad is, you know, I did not like Batman v Superman, a very morose, a very chaotic vision from Zack Snyder, one take on the DC universe, just piling on ideas and not really getting to its main event ever. Even when you get to it, it's deflated. Just a bad time of the movies. And yet, looking back from Suicide Squad, that feels like a singular vision. It feels like its own movie in some way, its own failure. This is put together, you know, you often talk about editing as this kind of invisible craft, and we can't really detect it. We don't know what's, you know, who made what decisions or how things are really being assembled. But man, this is like the Joker took a chainsaw to this movie and ripped it apart. I think there are traces of David Ayer and his filmography all over this movie. It's very much a men on a mission. There's a lot of squad action, like his cop movies, like Fury. And you can almost detect that kind of grime, the street level, gangster type of movies that he's made in the past in some of these later scenes. But God, it's mangled, right? This is so many different visions, so sloppily edited. If I don't like this movie for a big, big reason, it's because it just seems like patchwork.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I think that there is... I found any sort of consistency to actually be earlier in the film rather than later, you know, by which point my interest had completely evaporated. But I know one point of contention between us, one place where we differ in regards to this movie, is that I thought that while not every needle drop is effective and one that cribs from Guardians of the Galaxy and really underlines for anyone this hadn't occurred to already that this is DC's attempt to ape that very successful installment of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, at least commercially successful, I did think that the preponderance of music from that very, very, very recognizable music, very famous songs. I mean, the music budget on this movie must have been ridiculous. So we're talking like Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, Spirit in the Sky is a song that I referenced earlier. We are talking...
Every number one hit from rock radio in the last 30
grounds,
years.
I mean, these songs are played to introduce these characters, and I did think that it helped sort of ground the movie in our reality to say that, like, these characters are interesting because not because of the universe that they occupy, but because of its relationship to our own. And I thought that was neat. I think that's one of the things that people do enjoy about Guardians of the Galaxy, that unlike the plastic nonsense that is around the Avengers movie, you have this movie that takes place in another galaxy, and yet the music of the 80s is the sort of the bridge between...
But that's what made the kind of stock... dad rock tunes in Guardians of the Galaxy more fun because it's we're so far removed from reality. Here is this mixtape in a tape deck, but here it just feels stock.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of the music cues are curated for these specific characters. What is Deadshot really listening to when he goes on one of his assassination missions?
Who knows?
Well,
who cares? I mean, the only one good choice I can think of is...
Who cares? That's the whole movie, because the movie is wall-to-wall music.
Well, no. I mean, I ask who cares No one in the audience will. David Ayer's made it once upon a time, but David Ayer. But the You Don't Own Me, in used to introduce Harley Quinn, is, you know, on the nose like all the rest of them, but sort of effective in its own right. But I did think that there was the right energy there. There was this sort of brash, it wasn't necessarily effective, but you could see the attempt and the sort of attempt to subvert the tone, to go for that lighter tongue-in-cheek sort of misanthropic vibe. I felt that I started to lose interest when I realized that all of these characters weren't bad. They are no worse than, in a genre defined by people like Captain America, who are, goody two-shoes to the extreme, these sort of literally grown in a lab, all-American super soldiers. Anyone that has a shade of gray is, on the other end of the moral spectrum. But all these characters are so eminently redeemable that it's really hard to believe in the danger factor that it's selling. The movie ends up feeling a lot more like a Hot Topic version of a supervillain movie than it does one with real guts, with real conviction, with real courage, and that trickles down to every aspect of this movie, so that none of the character motivations feel real or earned. None of the action has any weight to it. As Matt said earlier, it's all shot in the dark. It's all chopped up. That editing he's talking about, it's evident not just in the story beats, not just in the shot of Joel Kinnaman eating a chicken wing by a window.
Best moment. I lost it.
It's ridiculous. I could hear you cackling with Dorian from several rows ahead.
I don't know why. He's in this room, and he has this beautiful girl sitting on the couch, and all he could do is watch the rain and eat a chicken wing. I don't know. It's bizarre. And his whole goal is to watch her.
Where
to watch
her. Where did the chicken come from?
He just pulls it off screen. It's like Captain Boomerang and his beard. Everyone has the power to grab what they need to eat or drink.
It's crazy, and it's also like that is the moment, right? That
actually starts the plot. An hour in, she does something bizarre. She summons her brother
off the ball to eat this fucking chicken wing. and you watch this movie and you think about the trailers and the sort of vibe they captured and how that got everybody excited, and really much more so than Batman v Superman, which I think was a tougher needle to thread. You just think, how did they fuck this up? Like, in a very history of violence like expression, like how do you fuck this up?
Less would have been so much more. Like, just get them in a room, do quick introductions, and get to the meat of this movie, which is throwing them in the middle of the city and they have to fight their way through.
Or like, why not go? I mean, obviously Paul Thomas Anderson would be a little bit too high to shoot for something like this, but you can think of anything, even Love Actually, with the interweaving plot lines, if you want to actually root these characters in any sort of emotional foothold so that we care about them.
Or any war movie.
Payoffs. Like, why not actually either go the opposite direction of just running into it and actually spend time with them and understand them, so that we don't, the one organic scene in the movie when all the Suicide Squad is sitting around having a drink right at the start of the third act, and they interrupt it by going deep into Diablo's whole backstory, having him tell us exactly what happened.
It kind of crossed a weird line for me. Like, stark reality is one thing, but it seemed like parody. It seemed like stereotype and weird parody to me. I don't know. And then later we get to see his character. So the scene you're describing is Diablo flashing back, and he's with his family, and he erupts, and he burns his whole house down. I think he kills his wife, or does he just burn her? Whatever.
My interpretation was that he killed
his
wife
died.
And his children.
Yes, and his children. And then later he has a dream where he's about to get blown by his wife. And this is his, like, dream scenario, to get his family back. But specifically, so his wife is about to give him a blowjob? It's so weird! That is super weird.
I guess I thought about, I mean, it's the way that she's positioned. It's hard not to think about her blowing him. It's not that overt. But anyway.
But you're absolutely right that it's like, oh, here's a trace of a character moment. But it's so frenetic. It's, I don't know, chopping in and out. Why do we need these character moments?
Yeah, it's, I wish that they had just been presented a different way. Because if you phrase the question differently, you say, like, why do we need these characters to be more than their ability, is to actually have a purpose, to have some sort of conflict or want or so on. I mean, in Diablo's character is the closest to it. There's a little bit of an arc, which is high praise for the characters of this movie, from him being a inadvertent killer to being a pacifist to being goaded into using his powers again, but this time for good. But with Harlequin, yeah, she, in the course of one night, and again, this movie takes place over just a few hours, really, she goes from being a psychotic sociopathic loner to being a psychotic sociopathic person who looks at everyone around her as this group, as a tight-knit family all of a sudden.
Well, and Diablo actually says, at the end of the movie, he's struggling. Should he go like full force with his flame powers, or should he hold back and hide? But he's like, I lost my first family. I'm not going to lose this one. Right. It's like, dude, you guys are not friends.
You've known each other for maybe 90 minutes.
In fact, you
minutes.
Are bad guys. I've heard it about 8,000 times.
Yeah. We're bad guys. It's what we do.
No, I will say this. The characterizations are very thin, but Will Smith and Viola Davis need to spin off and do their own movie immediately, because I am into Deadshot and I'm into Amanda Waller, even though that whole Will Smith daughter thing is really stilted. And there's a
Deadshot.
Horrible moment where he's like walking past a mall and sees like a
oh,
coat
God.
And it reminds him of his daughter. Jeez, David Ayer, you do not get people. No. You don't get them. Sorry.
I preferred Deadshot when his name was Leon, the professional. And the character is essentially Leon meets Hancock, just because he exists in sort of the superhero milieu. Not that Deadshot, I mean, he's a great shot.
He drinks less.
Yeah, but he doesn't have any. It's unclear if he's a metahuman with like this brilliant eye. I think he's presented in this film as just a very, very, very skilled marksman. But yeah, I'm not so sold on the character. Viola Davis's character is the only character in the movie who has an interestingly murky moral compass.
I mean, her moral compass is spinning out of control by the end of this movie, because she is the only bad guy in the movie. As far as I'm concerned, there's a scene where they rescue her. The whole middle section of this movie is absurd. And talk about like this insular Oris Boros. They have all caused this problem for themselves, and now they're going to bust Viola Davis out of a skyscraper, just basically a terrible version of The Raid for about 30 minutes. And you find out she's in a building, and this is all of her own making. They're rescuing her from her own design. And then she murders the entire staff of this government agency because they've, I don't know, witnessed this event.
It's her fucking fault for not getting them clearance, right?
Like, right!
Take 2 seconds, do the paperwork. Jeez.
It's just online. All you had to do was send an email. You get it back. You get the secure link. Click it. Come on. Get these kids in. They were interns.
Yeah, but I mean,
like, college credit.
She is an interesting character, potentially. It doesn't really pan out. It would be nice if her character ever showed any emotion. I think Viola Davis has been a little bit... I mean, she does this very, very, very well. But between this and...
what else are you thinking of?
Movies that she's been in recently.
Do you watch How to Get Away with Murder?
She's given at least a very limited emotional range. She tends to play these authority figures who are disciplinarians, who are harsh, and they could use a little bit of flavor there. She's not afforded it here. But yes, is considerably more interesting
but
than
Will
many
Smith.
Other characters in the movie.
Will Smith has a spot.
But Patches, would
He's
you
going
say,
places.
Would you say, actually, I'll frame this in a different way. Are there worse villains, and I mean real, like, antagonists, not just, we're bad guys, but the antagonists in any superhero movie than Enchantress is here?
I'm trying to think. Who is worse than Enchantress? How many other villains rave dance in order to conjure spells, doomsday machines that are unidentifiable? How many of them conjure the robot bad guy from the first Thor movie for absolutely no reason? Who has no motivation whatsoever? I don't understand.
It's elves, right? Like, even the dark elves are better.
It is true. Like, what is she after? I mean, we have seen this movie, and I'm not exactly sure her plan. She's been in a statue for a while. Now, I imagine that's kind of like a Jafar syndrome, right? You don't, you once, I'm sorry, I'm talking about Aladdin 2 here, when Jafar gets back out of the lamp. You know, it's stuffy in there, so she wants to wreak havoc. And
well, she says that the humans turned on her. They used to worship her as a god, and they turned on her, and now she wants to rid them of the earth.
I really want to see the movie where the Aztecs put her in that bottle for the first time.
Yeah, how'd they do that?
I don't know. Stones?
And all of this, and the reason that there's any sort of confusion here is because what little context there is packed into one throwaway line that I think she's delivering to a character that's not even on screen at the time. And then you're expected to give a shit. You're expected to give a shit because she's possessing the body of Joel Kinnaman's love interest, but I assure you, you will not.
There's a lot of confusing cross-cutting in this movie where they'll present something happening. So in this, Joel Kinnaman's going to plant a bomb to kill the first occurrence of this supernatural phenomenon. And I'm not sure why a bomb is going to help, but he brings the Enchantress with him, and that's it. That's the end of the scene. Now, later in the movie, they cut back to this scene to explain it, and we see most of that first scene again, and then Enchantress is there standing and disappears. I just learned this information already, minus just a little bit that could have been shown me, because Joel Kinnaman is talking about it in both scenes. I don't know. It's all very, very confusing for no reason.
Dude, this is not something that David Ayer has had a problem with in the past.
No!
I mean, I have plenty of negative things to say about End of Watch or
Sabotage is a fluid, coherent movie.
I never saw Sabotage. But, you know, whatever your criticisms of End of Watch and Fury, those are movies that have a very visceral sense of place. They create a strong physical reality where you understand what it's like to be in a tank. You understand the geography of what's happening in that last sequence with Logan Lerman. He's surrounded by all these Nazis. You understand just Jake Gyllenhaal is running around the streets of Los Angeles. You were there on the ground with him. Seeing what he sees, you feel it, and those, you would think, or I assumed, I gave him the benefit of the doubt, that those would not be the problems that afflicted this movie, and yet they are in a huge way.
I don't think there's a good action sequence in the movie.
No.
I take that back. The first time we meet Deadshot, and he assassinates a guy and sets up these cool, like, bullet bouncing off plates.
Sure.
That's kind of neat.
Yeah, I mean, but there's hardly, in the other action sequences, forget good sequences. I mean, there's hardly memorable beats within those sequences. I mean, I think like the one shot even that I can remember is when Harley Quinn is thrown out of a helicopter and like rolls on a rooftop of a building and goes straight into a stride in her heels is one moment that pops out. But the rest of it is just sort of
the only image there. I can remember is when Harley Quinn appears in her classic Batman animated series costume and the Joker is dancing with her, and then they recreate this panel from, or it's a cover by Alex Ross. It has absolutely nothing to do with the movie, and it's all catnip, and I find this movie to be exactly that every step of the way. Just like, I don't know who the fans that they're servicing are, because Suicide Squad is mostly it's an obscure set of characters, so I don't know what the service is, but why is Captain Boomerang in this movie? I guess that's my point. Jai Courtney, you know, as much as we rang on Jai Courtney, barely registers in this movie, so he's probably safe.
Yeah, I mean, he's all personality. I mean, it's not as though another actor could have done more with that part.
Does he kill anyone? Does he serve a purpose on this team? It's Does his hard. Boomerang hurt anything?
His purpose is to be the guy who is very reluctant to go along with the program, who is looking to wriggle out of the deal at every
poor Slipknot. He's the
turn.
Captain Boomerang Slipknot is the reason Slipknot is dead.
Yeah.
Blood is on his hands.
This is a real disaster. This is a real disaster for a whole studio and series of movies. Every time you want to give them a little bit of leeway, you want to give them another chance, they just shit your face.
I really wanted to like this movie, especially after the fallout of Batman v Superman, as a Green Lantern apologist. And I think people who rag on critics for hating the DC Universe forget that a lot of us, I mean, I love Batman Begins. I think The Dark Knight is a really good movie, and The Dark Knight Rises, passable. You know, if it came out this summer, it would be the greatest blockbuster of all time.
Yeah, but what have you done for me lately? You know, that's a long time ago.
And it is.
The DC fans, I remember I wasn't really in the review game back then. I don't think I wrote formal reviews of any of those films. I do remember the DC fans, the rabid ones, going after some people at the time. But it does feel as if it has become even more toxic since then. And maybe that's just an inevitable reaction to the movies getting worse. I mean, that need for validation becomes more intense as the movies provide less and less of it.
So Nine Lives, starring Kevin Spacey. See it. This episode, let's answer this week's lightning round question, which was in honor of Suicide Squad. What cinematic villain deserves a turn as the hero for a change? David, who are you going to go?
I'll go with Brian Hatfield at B Hattie 2, who says, I vote for a heist film with Hans Gruber as the protagonist. Well, I would vote for the opportunity to see Alan Rickman do anything at this point, but I think that that'd be great. It'd be fun to see that as his henchman.
Alan Rickman. No, they would cast someone younger. They would go. Who is the younger Alan Rickman? Do we have that person yet?
Yeah. Oh, who comes to mind as the younger Alan?
Someone British.
Yeah.
Someone stiff and British. Oh wait, what's that guy who was in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, but also Control?
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
I'm looking this up. This is important. That guy is the younger Sam Riley.
Sam
he
Riley.
Is the younger Alan Rickman. I would see him. In,
sure. Why not?
I'm going to go with at Will Kosh, who said Roxy Richter from Scott Pilgrim. We'd all watch that, right? Mm. Sure.
Sure.
I would. I want another Scott Pilgrim movie. I didn't even love Scott Pilgrim the way other people do, and I kind of pine for the. I don't know. It was a breath of fresh air.
But
that aesthetic working.
One of the beautiful things about Scott Pilgrim, which is a movie that we'll never get a sequel, is that it's done. I mean, like, it is a story told well, and there is really nothing else to do with it. Of course, you can take any one of those characters and spin them off. You could have a movie about his roommate or whatever. I mean, the sky's the limit, but why would you?
Knowing what we know about reboot culture, we'll probably get a television version of Scott Pilgrim.
Movie bombs,
10 years from now.
But what are you gonna do?
Oh, movies can bomb and be rebooted. Come on. If it took place in the 80s, it basically does. Well, before we go, we should actually mention that our comrade, Katie Rich, has answered this week's lightning round question. And she said, Anton Chigurh?
Yeah. Chigurh
from No Country for Old Men. She suggests a wacky road trip movie. The poor sucker who has to go on a road trip with Anton.
Hi, Katie.
I'm not sure. If you're listening, Katie, tweet at us. So that does it for this week's Fighting of the War Room. Why don't we tell people where they can find us, David?
I am the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can read my writing on IndieWire. I wrote a long review that reiterates a lot of the things you said here about Suicide Squad on the site. And that's me.
And I'm Captain Boomerang, and I am senior editor, David, editor of Thrillist.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and you can follow the hashtag that Julie Klausner of Difficult People keeps tweeting out, hashtag Patches, because apparently there's an episode about Patches, who is a mentally challenged balloon salesman, and that is my new life. So I've been taken over by Difficult People. That's it for this week. We will be back next with more talk with Joanna and Dave. We will talk to you then.